The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books podcast with me, Claire Armistead.
And me, Sian Kane.
Fresh back from your travels, Sian.
Yay.
This week, data scientist Alexander Boxer looks back over the history of astrology and reveals what it tells us about the past and the future of science. And later in the show, we'll be talking about the books that transformed our outlook on life. Alexander Boxer has a doctorate in physics from MIT, a master's degree in the history of science from Oxford, and a bachelor's in classical language from Yale. His debut book looks at the surprising history and science of astrology from a data perspective. Richard Lee began the interview by asking what on earth a data scientist is doing writing about astrology and horoscopes.
That's a great question. So let me start out by saying that I myself am not an astrologer. I don't believe in astrology, but I became very interested in the question about what astrology is, and in particular, how astrology can be a mirror to some of the very empirical, very data-driven algorithms that we're generating today to talk about our personal preferences, et cetera, things that astrologers in the past were also very interested in.
As you say, I mean, the astrology of the past, that stretches back quite a long way. The first flowerings of astrology were in Egypt, Babylon, Rome, and Alexandria. But the central figure, you argue, is that the man who made all previous astrology superfluous to the working astrologer was Claudius Ptolemy. Who was he, and what did he achieve?
He is a Greek astronomer living in Roman Egypt, in Roman Alexandria, and he comes up with this very comprehensive system for how you can use mathematics to compute the positions of the stars and planets at any time in the past, present, or future. Now, this is, of course, a great exercise in astronomy and mathematics, but he was doing it, as many of the mathematicians and astronomers were at the time, because there was this great practical need to know these positions because they were used for astrology. So Ptolemy writes his famous astronomy book, The Almagest. He also writes a famous astrology book called The Tetrabiblos that was extremely influential, and it was so much so that it was remained part of the curriculum that Copernicus himself had to study from when he went to Bologna to study astronomy. And of course, you had to study astronomy if you wanted a degree in medicine, because you had to know astrology in order to make proper diagnoses and give prescriptions. So all of this stuff is really developing hand in hand for thousands of years. So he really sets the groundwork for so much of the astrology as we have it today. He also was the ancient world's greatest geographer. So there's this sort of fun section in his Tetrabiblos, his astrology book, where he talks about astrological geography. So it's sort of the one place in all of his writings where he gets to combine astronomy, astrology, and geography together. And he has this whole map of the world that he lays out, and he talks about how each of the different ethnicities from Britain all the way, you know, into Persia and India, their peculiar quirks and habits are determined by the stars and planets.
Contemporary accounts of Ptolemy in history of science books often get him almost the other way around, that he was kind of a great astronomer, a great geographer, and they kind of try and leave the astrology to one side. You're suggesting that that's kind of backwards. It was actually the geography and the astronomy were just ways and means for him of getting to astrology.
All of these things are happening together. They're interwoven and braided together, and it's not fair to remove one of these things from the history. Just like it's not fair to remove astrology from the history of astronomy or even the history of science. Let's recall that the entire scientific revolution begins with astronomy and begins with this realization that certain problems that physicists had claimed were their own, actually this other group, the mathematicians, had all of a sudden realized that they were able to make claims that previously only physicists were able to talk about, namely, what is the structure of the solar system of the universe? And this is really coming out of this astrological problem. These are the people who are pushing the ball forward with mathematics and what sorts of questions you can answer with numbers and mathematics. In the ancient world, there always was this strict division of, you know, what questions were physical questions, what questions were mathematical questions, and the interplay between the two was always very unclear. And there were usually strict divisions saying that, well, numbers are pure, they're eternal, they're good for describing certain things, but they're definitely not good for describing many physical processes in the world which involve change, which involve things corrupting and growing. And so the scientific revolution was in many ways, possibly its most important ways, a mathematical revolution, where it became clear that at least for certain questions, mathematics was the way you had to go and answer them.
Going back to the scientific revolution, as you do, I mean, there's something that histories of science often do is leap straight from the Greeks to Copernicus, missing out all the stuff in the middle. But in the book, you argue that there was a whole lot of work going on in Baghdad without which the scientific revolution never would have happened. But aren't these technical advances, the kind of precision instruments, the accurate measurements that were going on in the Arabic world, aren't they necessary but not sufficient conditions for advances in science?
Necessary but not sufficient, I think, is a fair statement. And I think, you know, everybody would recognize the importance of Arabic contributions to the history of astronomy and the history of science. But when you scratch beneath the surface and you say, well, how does it really work? I think a lot of people find themselves a little befuddled. In particular, you're looking at someone like Copernicus, and they perceive the scientific revolution as being nothing more than a theoretical revolution or a metaphysical revolution, that really the key element was Copernicus reordering the order of the cosmos. I just have this very strong sense that science develops with practical applications hand in hand, that our theoretical understanding of the world is very much shaped by the practical applications to which these things can be applied. And so the Arabic contribution is fascinating to me because astrology is tremendously important at this time. Some of the key figures are both astronomers and astrologers. There's a tremendous amount of work being done in astrology, and I think it leaves people very uncomfortable when they have to ask, well, are these developments in astrology, should they be considered important advances in science? But what's backing up all of these things is, as you mentioned, the technological development is continuing apace. Just the more precise instruments, the larger instruments, the more precise algorithms for determining planetary positions, and more people looking at Ptolemy and realizing that Ptolemy does not have all the answers. Even though it's Copernicus who finally switches the order, the idea that the sun would be at the center of the cosmos was not new with Copernicus. That idea had been known since ancient times, and the evidence for it was considered to be not persuasive. It's really not until you have people like Kepler and Tycho Brahe, and then, of course, Galileo, where the evidence that had been missing in the ancient and Arabic world finally becomes overwhelming to take this, again, very ancient idea and realize that it was correct.
Going back to the ancients, as you do, I mean, you're pretty hard on Lucretius, the Roman poet who proposed a picture of the universe consisting of atoms swerving in the void, suggesting that the uncanny resemblance of his metaphysics to modern science is nothing but a lucky guess. But he was proposing a mechanism that would explain features of the world we live in, and he turned out to be very much right. What more could you ask?
So I happen to be a big fan of Lucretius. I think it's his poem is a beautiful poem, and the number of things he gets right is almost shocking. But yes, I think if you're interested in the history of science, how do you deal with characters like this? And in particular, how do you deal with characters on the other side who are getting some of these ideas wrong? And I think a person like Lucretius, you have to recognize that yes, he can seem that he's thousands of years ahead of his time, but if you're making these metaphysical statements about the universe without any physics to back it up, yes. So I make the claim that it's a bit of a lucky guess, and you know we have to be careful when we look back at these ancient thinkers. What really is driving advance in science? It's not simply about getting the metaphysics right. For me, it's about moving the technology forward in physics. The ability to actually understand and demonstrate that the world is made of atoms, of course, has to wait many thousands of years after Lucretius. And so the argument is a larger argument that I apply to astrology, too, that yes, these characters are ultimately incorrect in how they see what's driving the universe and our interactions with it. But curiously, they are the ones who are the most adventurous and the most forceful in pushing a mathematical way of understanding the world. So much so that the term mathematician, mathematicus, in the ancient world comes to be synonymous with astrologers. These are the only people who are, astrological work is the mathematical work that people do professionally. And a lot of people thought this was very silly that you could describe all of these human affairs with mathematics. But And in many cases, they were correct. But what I think people failed to appreciate was how much mathematics would, once it became ripe and mature, be able to describe the physical world in which we live. And this is the world we live in today.
Yes, but in many cases, you say they weren't correct. It was just plain wrong. I mean, don't we need to discuss deceit? Astrology just doesn't work. And that's been clear for a long time. I mean, you've got Mayan O'Mayneri confessing to Petrarch in the 14th century that it was just fake. So aren't astrologers, even if they've got some clever instruments and fancy mathematics, aren't they just not playing the game?
So some of them, and Mayan O'Mayneri is a fascinating character who I talk about in the book, and yes, he does express his frustration, and he realizes that he's playing a game that he himself doesn't quite believe in. But I actually think Mayneri is probably sincere in his belief that these methods may work. I think it's really not until after someone like Kepler where astrologers really have to ask themselves what are they doing and why. And but I think that Kepler, to me, is the dividing line. He himself was very interested in what you could do with the mathematics of astronomy and astrology. He pursues them both vigorously. And by the end of his career, after he's had these tremendous successes with astronomy and finding within the data that he's looking at, his laws of planetary motion, he's also casting horoscopes with his own hand, over 1,000 of them, looking for patterns too. He's not able to find them. But up until that time, I think it was a very open and honest question whether these methods would bear any fruit. And I think, you know, people make this connection a lot, but I think it's a fair connection that if you look at something like meteorology today, it's very difficult to predict the weather. And many times people do it wrong, people do it badly, but that doesn't mean that there's not value in at least attempting to push the technology forward and push these predictive models forward.
Do you think that that means we should be cautious about these new techniques, these new big data techniques?
Oh, of course. And working, let's say, in the trenches of it, I get to see more horrible models than good models. That doesn't mean the technology isn't an exciting technology to be around, but like with anything with a lot of hype, most you have to separate the wheat from the chaff. And to a certain extent, my book was started by looking at some of these really tremendously bad models that you've seen in the press, in particular, let's say the stock market crash and the housing market crisis that all sorts of economic models claimed could never happen. And most famously in the United States, all of the election forecasts for 2016, some of which gave Hillary Clinton a 99% chance of winning. Now, all of these models...
We know how that turned out.
We do know how that turned out. And all these models rely on very sophisticated statistics and mathematics. And part of me wanted to say, are these doing any better than astrology? Wouldn't it be fun to set up an astrological baseline just to see what models could even beat superstitious astrology? And that's sort of what got me thinking that although I have a longstanding interest in the history of science and the history of astronomy, I didn't really know much about astrology, and I certainly didn't know how it worked as a technical practice. And that was what I was very interested in, is astrology as a technology and sort of seeing them as the original data scientists. I think we think today of astrology as a form of cosmic mysticism, which I think that largely describes it correctly today. And so people look to the past and think that past astrologers would also be this species of cosmic mystic. And I think that that's actually mistaken. I look at these ancient astrologers and see them in very much the same vein as a modern statistician or a modern data scientist.
So if astrologers almost by accident invented astronomy and launched a scientific revolution, should we expect a similar kind of revolution from the developments in data science today?
Well, of course, you can never, who can really predict the future? Let's say, distinct from an astrologer, I do not believe that any of us can really predict the future. But I think it's an interesting question where people who support pure science oftentimes make the claim that, well, you have to be investigating all of these things because you don't really know where it will lead. And in particular, from a practical application point of view, many practical applications have been developed by studying things which were originally designed to do something else. And I think actually these arguments work very well to astrology, at least to ancient astrology, where I would argue that astrology is the practical application that is driving all of this. When you look at questions of charting the positions of the sun, the moon, and the stars, those had always been very important for timekeeping, regulating calendars, and also navigation and surveying. But if you ask the question, what use was there for predicting with great precision the coordinates of the planets? There's no practical application in the ancient world, except for astrology. And yet, for thousands of years, people are paying money to support these observations. People are interested in improving these observations. And again, it's these observations which, perhaps a surprise to everyone involved, led to the scientific revolution and the modern world that we know today. So it's a good example that, yes, it's very hard to predict where the future will go. And something as off script as astrology may actually be the driving force of what has turned into our modern, very anti-astrological perception of the universe.
That was Alexander Boxer. A Scheme of Heaven, The History of Astrology and the Search for Our Destiny in Data is published by Profile Books in the UK and W.W. Norton in the US. After the break, we'll be talking about the books that changed our understanding of the world.
Too often in science podcasts, we hear voices not of the people who might be affected by new discoveries, but of those who made them. What if we flip that on its head?
Like, my father's 50 and praise God that he's still alive, but that's through kidney transplant, ripping a vein out of his leg to put in his arm. That's through having 8 units of blood every month, and that's touch and go if he actually gets that. This could stop that.
With our Common Threads podcast, we travelled around the country to hear people's questions, hopes and fears when it comes to something called gene editing. It's a technology that could one day allow us to rewrite our DNA.
Actually, my son has severe learning difficulties, so he doesn't have capacity to make any decision for himself. I'd say that he's very happy in his skin. The only person that has suffered because of him is me. Would I change him if I could? No.
My daughter's got an extra chromosome, and I would absolutely delete that. And it's not to change her, it's to change that extra chromosome that holds her back.
It's important as well to give context, because we're all here and we're all people of African origin, and I think that very much shapes our response to things like this, because our history of being abused by science shapes us.
To have a listen, just search Common Threads on your podcast app or head over to theguardian.com, where you'll find all the content from our Gene Gap project.
Welcome back to the Guardian Books podcast. You may currently be following the Harvey Weinstein trial on the news. Whilst we won't pass comment on the overall case, I did find it interesting that on Tuesday, Weinstein's lawyer complained that a juror was reading books on predatory older men and reviewing them online on Goodreads during the proceedings. Well, that's according to Vulture. It just got me thinking, to what degree books can shape or change our perspective on life, people and cultures, while also signalling who we are. Sian, there are a couple of issues in this, aren't there?
Yeah, so it's quite a strange example. I guess it raises an interesting question about whether our tastes in books can signal what our political beliefs or our moral beliefs are. And so in this case, Weinstein's defense team went over the juror's Goodreads account and saw that she had recently read My Dark Vanessa by Kate Elizabeth Russell, which is a really sort of buzzy recent novel that has recently come out in the US and is just coming out in the UK. And it's been getting a lot of press because it's about a woman who reconsiders her teenage relationship with a predatory teacher after another woman goes public about her relationship with that teacher. And she was also reading Vanessa Springora's memoir, Le Consentiment, which is a French book, which is also about a woman's relationship, Vanessa's relationship with an older male. And the judge ruled that this juror could stay as she was reading this book, but she wasn't reviewing it. So she'd put on Goodreads that she was reading Springora's memoir, but she wasn't reviewing it just yet. And it's so interesting to think that our books might sort of signal where our sympathies might lie, in this case, in a legal case.
I've noticed on Goodreads, which I actually increasingly use for research, I find it's very interesting if I want to find out how an author is regarded by general readership rather than by the critics, say, I look on Goodreads, and quite often authors signal their membership of a certain sort of literature by reviewing the books by a sort of iconic author in their area.
Mm, exactly, yes. And that was actually the case with this juror, because this juror is also an author herself, and she has also written books about predatory older men, apparently. So I kind of get maybe on
a
the face
bit of
it.
Of product placement.
My Weinstein might be, Weinstein's defense team might be concerned about that. But it seems that she also is reading within that sphere as well, which is like quite a normal thing. Like quite a lot of authors do use Goodreads accounts to sort of signal what they are reading as well.
So this brings up the whole issue of book signalling who you are and what status we should give to them.
Mm.
And there's always this party game that comes up at least once a year when all the politicians set off on their summer holidays, isn't there?
Of
what are they going to take
with
them?
Dull, dry reading lists that you can never produce.
When Barack Obama revealed his summer reading in 2015, our Guardian critic Mark Lawson noted that one of his choices was a biography of the first US president, Washington. And Lawson said, by telling his fellow Americans that he's spending his penultimate summer in office with that book, Obama might as well be saying, Mount Rushmore? Now, how about it? That's pretty harsh.
Yeah.
But I mean, and we know that Obama is a genuine reader who has very good taste.
I find that amazing, though, that Obama's not even president anymore and he still releases a reading list. Like, that sort of shows that he did actually have some cultural cred, that people still are interested what he's reading every year.
Yeah, and I mean, that is, one can never fault the books that he had on his list. I'm always a bit more concerned when by politicians who name Ayn Rand's crypto-fascist Fountainhead as one of their favourites, and you know, both Donald Trump and the newly departed UK Chancellor of the Exchequer, Sajid Javid, claimed its architect protagonist Howard Rourke as a hero for his gung-ho, go-it-alone attitudes, as have a load of Hollywood stars, from Brad Pitt to Sandra Bullock.
I swear, like, half of the people that claim Fountainhead is their favourite book, they haven't read it.
They
no
just
one
got this idea
it,
in their head.
That book. I mean, there's a funny reputation that some authors have that precede them. So, and this is particularly a thing now with like dating apps. If there's ever a guy that says that he loves reading David Foster Wallace or Haruki Murakami, that's like a massive red flag. It basically shows that he's a literary know-it-all.
Well, then there's the recently proclaimed Lee Child fan club, which the author Joanna Trollope, who's a different sort of genre novelist, described as reverse snobbery.
Yes, I find that really, it's really interesting how there are certain authors that some, you would say, intellectual types deign to read or deign to admit that they like.
Yeah, and there's a long history of that. There's a long history of that, and it's usually people, hard-boiled writers, isn't it? Like, I mean, going all the way back to Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler.
Raymond Chandler's one of my favourite authors.
And it's not to say that they're not good, but it's not to say that Joanna Trollope isn't good as well, but people wouldn't sort of confess.
People infer something from you liking Joanna Trollope, and they infer something from you liking Murakami. And I like Murakami, but I've got to say, it has actually kind of rather tainted my view of him, having read so many anecdotes about the kinds of guys that like Murakami. You do start to really notice just how creepy he is about women when you read his novels.
So what about books that have transformed you, or that, you know, have become important in the your sense of who you are? You're just back from holiday, aren't you?
Yeah, so I've been on sabbatical for the last month, and the joke is always, oh, you go and write your novel, and I haven't. I've just read a lot of other people's novels. I was travelling in Mexico, and I decided while I was away I was going to read purely for pleasure, and I decided to go back and read an author that I felt was very formative for me, and her name's Tamora Pierce. She's an American young adult novelist, and she wrote a series of quartets all set in the same fantasy universe. And the first is called The Song of the Lioness, and it's all about a girl who disguises herself as a boy to go train as a knight, because in this world they don't allow women to serve in the military. And each book progresses over time, and by the end of that quartet she's in her early 20s. But because all the books are set in the same universe, other quartets that come after that don't follow her, but she's a background character. So you get to see this character go from about 10 years old to in her 40s. And it was really, really interesting to go back and read something that I had felt was very important to me, because it was a book that all of these books were about women, and they were a lot about how women are treated differently to men. And I had not really been aware of gender inequality when I first read them. I was about 10 or 11 when I first read them. And going back and reading something when you're almost 30 that you liked as a child and finding actually that they're quite sophisticated in terms of how they handle romantic relationships and friendships, how they also teach quite gentle lessons about gender inequality, but also quite serious lessons, was really great. I was so pleased that actually I did have quite good taste as a 10-year-old. And I really enjoyed going back and reading these books. So I read 13 books while I was on holiday, and 12 of them were by Tamora Pierce.
That's pretty impressive.
That was great.
You know, what did you do for leisure during this holiday of yours?
Didn't talk to my partner very much. I just did a lot of reading. But it was a really wonderful experience to be able to read them as an adult and go, oh, God, these are really genuinely very sophisticated works, and like genuinely very touching to see how characters age and how characters, particularly how the men she wrote treated the women with lots of respect. Like the women do encounter challenges because of their gender, but they're also surrounded by a wonderful amount of very good men that treat the women with a huge amount of respect.
So could you see yourself in the books as you were reading them, your young self? I mean, could you remember what it felt like to read them the first time round?
Yes, and I could remember there were like key scenes and instances where I was like, oh God, this has sort of always been hanging in the back of my head. Like I remember the excitement of this scene or the shock of this particular chapter. And I could even do it just like I'd turn a page and there'd be the new chapter title and I'd go, oh God, yes, I remember this bit, so even before I've read it. And, you know, I was reading these almost 20 years ago, so it's a really, really fun experience.
We were talking earlier, weren't we, about whether we actually read like that, whether we read for transformational reasons or whether we relate to books in that way. And I think that I probably generally don't. But one book that really, really affected me and I think has really changed me in a way that I am still processing was Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's Half of a Yellow Sun. Because I grew up in Nigeria during the Civil War, but I was in the North. So I was fed propaganda. And when you're fed propaganda as a child, even though you're told that it was propaganda, it's quite difficult to lose that sense of your childhood attachment to a particular vision of history. And it wasn't until I read Half of a Yellow Sun that I understood, really understood in a sort of visceral, emotional way, that atrocities that were happening in that country while I was living a happy life, cycling around untroubled roads and things a few hundred miles away.
And so had you encountered much about Nigeria in fiction before?
Yeah, yes, but not the Biafran side of the Civil War. And you know, I sort of knew it, but I didn't know it.
Yes.
And I think that that's where fiction can actually go to places that facts don't. They can actually unlock parts of you. And when I say I'm still processing it, it sort of made me realise that there are parts of my childhood that were based on an illusion. And once you come to that realization, you begin to go through all sorts of doors, and you know, and the whole edifice comes tumbling down. And of course, in my case, part of the edifice is the edifice of post-colonialism, the feeling that we were post-colonial, therefore we weren't the same as those people in South Africa and East Africa, but actually we were, and we were part of a big conspiracy to tell the truth about the most dreadful things.
God. And you've met Chimamanda before. Have you talked to her about this?
Briefly, yeah. Yes, when it first came out. But it's sort of, I do feel really changed by it. Anyway, if you, our listeners, have any thoughts about books that have changed you, please do get in touch on Twitter at Guardian Books or on the podcast page. And you can always subscribe and review us wherever you get your podcasts from. But that's all for this week. Next week, we'll be talking to Isabel Greenberg about Bronte Juvenilia and the long-awaited third instalment in Hilary Mantel's Cromwell trilogy, The Mirror and the Light. Dun, 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 dun.
It's a book that everyone's been waiting for about 10 years.
It's got so many expectations.
I saw a guy reading it on the tube last night. He had a proof copy. And like, because
you resisted the temptation to seize it out of his hand.
I kept sort of like almost trying to waggle my eyebrows at him, like, oh, you work for a publisher or something. It's huge though. It's almost 1,000 pages. Anyway, sorry.
Anyway, well, that's going to keep us busy, isn't it, for a few months. But for now, from me, Claire Armistead.
And me, Sian Kane.
And our producer, Esther Opoku-Jenny. Thanks for listening and goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.